So, you know, it's so unfortunate sitting here and perhaps speaking as an African in that there is no political will to sort out the crisis that faces 60% of the African population. People are sitting without clean drinking water, without electricity, and which stalls a number of things in their lives, like the ability to get an education, to get food. And our leaders are disinterested.
And that was Lungile Mashele, who is an energy economist. This is the Power for All podcast, a forum for leaders working to end energy poverty. I'm your host, Matuba Mahlatsi, standing in for Christina Skirka. We are excited to be talking to Lungile Mashele, who, on top of being an energy expert in South Africa, teaches at various universities as well. Welcome, Lungile. Today we are looking at some trends that will dominate the energy sector in 2023. And today our focus will be on energy access and how the global energy crisis will improve or not. And if not, what are the options? South Africa will be the main case study as the country battles to keep the lights on. And Lungile will help us break down the crisis in that country. For our listeners joining us for this podcast, Power for All is a global campaign of over 300 partners around the world dedicated to ending energy poverty faster. You can learn more about Power for All on our website, powerforall.org, the socials, and of course by subscribing to our fantastic newsletter. As a 501c organization, Power for All depends on the generosity of listeners like you. Please consider supporting our work at powerforall.org/donate. Once again, Lungile, thank you so much for being in the first episode of Power for All's podcast for the year 2023. Let's take this time to ask you to introduce yourself, please, and to our listeners. And please feel free to touch on the work that you do in the energy space as well.
So good day. My name is Lungile Mashele. I am an energy economist. I work for the largest asset manager in Africa, and I look at energy projects and provide technical appraisal on energy projects all over the continent.
Okay, thank you. And so at the start of every year, we look at the energy sector and investigate what will trend in the year ahead. And I'm talking about this year, 2023. So the energy crisis, finance and all funding, because there's a very fine line between finance and funding of clean energy projects and energy in the global politics were some of the trends we came up with. So I'd like us to start at the very beginning of these crises, which is the pandemic, the COVID-19, and the economic rebound after the pandemic, and now the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I'd like to hear your forecast for the year based on these factors I have just mentioned.
Perfect. So, you know, let me start at COVID-19. 2020, everything stopped. The world came to an end. We had supply chain challenges. Prices of various inputs, especially in the renewable energy space, the prices of your inverters, your panels, they skyrocketed. What we're starting to actually see now is that these prices are starting to actually normalize. So in 2023, I do anticipate a major uptake, particularly of solar PV globally, and that's because the price has become more favorable. As the war in Russia or Ukraine stretches on, there will be a concerted effort on energy security, especially by European nations, and they will be scrambling to make sure that they get sufficient energy to take them through their next winter as well. This might see them looking or investing in hydrogen technology, for, you know, hydrogen gas, certainly more coal. They might even be looking as far afield as nuclear as well.
Well, that's interesting. And we also saw a possible resurgence of nuclear power to keep the lights on in countries like Germany and Japan, and even here in South Africa, where we only have one plant that might be used to avert the havoc that's currently unfolding. How sustainable is this, and why is clean energy not the obvious and cost-effective solution to nuclear power?
So, nuclear is, or people rather have fears around nuclear because of the proliferation. But this has been unfounded, over the years, ultimately. And I suppose when people think of nuclear, they're still associated with nuclear warfare, Nagasaki, Hiroshima, which is rather unfortunate. So there is some education which is required on that front. But I suppose more than anything, when people consider nuclear, they always hear of these big amounts. Yes, nuclear does have a huge, massive capital outlay, which is what we call the overnight cost. But if you look at nuclear's levelized cost and the fact that nuclear, unlike conventional renewable technologies, goes all the way up to about 70 years or even more, it does become, in the long run, the cheapest technology you can possibly install. So I do understand the need to go back to nuclear. However, one needs to caution, nuclear has significant time and cost overruns as well.
I see. Well, I'd like us to get into a bit of politics now. And the term political will is something that I've heard in conferences, especially climate conferences that I've been part of since I joined Power for All. And it has always been at the center of passing laws that embrace clean energy. All of the global climate change gatherings, especially COP, also rely on political will to secure a move towards achieving SDG 7 and SDG 8. What's your observation regarding so much power being in the hands of such few political elites when it has implications for millions of people, especially in sub-Saharan Africa?
So, it's so unfortunate sitting here and perhaps speaking as an African in that there is no political will to sort out the crisis that faces 60% of the African population. People are sitting without clean drinking water, without electricity, and which stalls a number of things in their lives, like the ability to get an education, to get food. And our leaders are disinterested. They were not interested in conventional technologies when they were still popular. Even now with renewable technologies, it seems to be about what and how they can possibly benefit, as opposed to how the citizens can benefit. There are a few examples on the continent. Sierra Leone comes to mind, where a crisis such as Ebola necessitated the use of electricity, like a spoken wheel model, to get electricity in particular areas that would power up clinics to treat people that had Ebola. And naturally, villages and communities and townships started forming around those clinics because of the access to electricity. Speaking again to the importance of having electrified nations.
Yeah, that's very true. And because it can save lives, actually, it can actually create jobs. Because one of our researchers at Power for All Powering Jobs has found that actually renewable energy will create millions of jobs if it's embraced the way it should be. But now, coming to South Africa, your home country and mine, where there is a struggle to keep the lights on. And when electricity is actually available, it's unaffordable. And for the benefit of our listeners on other continents, can you just sum up the South African power crisis and the possible solutions that we can use in keeping its place as the most industrial economy in Africa and making us prosper in our jobs at them? Because at the moment, we are struggling, as you would know.
Right. So South Africa's crisis is multifold, and it finds itself in politics, in operational issues, a lack of funding. You also have, and I suppose one of the biggest things is a lack of maintenance, and especially reliability maintenance over the last couple of years, which has brought us to this point. We're sitting with an EAF that is an energy availability factor, which is just below 50%, which means on any given day, less than 50% of Eskom's fleet is actually available. This does not bode well for any society that wants to grow or that is, aspires to any kind of education or agriculture or any industrial activity ultimately.
Yeah. And
PowerFoil also saw population growth as part of the trends in 2023. In some cases, and I suspect that's the case in South Africa, the traditional grids will continue to fail to cater to more people. As an energy expert, what's your advice to countries that want to ensure energy access and a just transition as their populations grow?
So, you know, Africa at the moment is sitting at about 1.4 billion people. We're also the youngest population in the world, and the fastest growing as well. 60% of these people find themselves without access to electricity at all. You cannot have the fastest growing and the youngest population being so disadvantaged. What this basically means, and should perhaps be a clarion call for every other nation, is that these young people will eventually pack up their bags and seek better fortunes around the world. Now, I'll give you the case of South Africa. In any given month, you have 30,000 new people entering Gauteng, looking for better education, better healthcare, better lives. They're looking for work. Now, these are people from all over, like the continent, or in fact, the world at this point. We also have people from other provinces in South Africa also. These 30,000 people, when they arrive here, naturally, most of them do not move into gated communities or into high-end homes. They are moving next to townships that have electricity, that have water, and they're setting up perhaps illegally in those areas. This creates friction with the communities that live there. And then, I mean, people get there and the first thing that they need is shelter, right? So they'll go around and they'll try and find structures to put over their heads, cardboard boxes, corrugated iron, the list is endless. Then the next thing that they're going to need is water. So naturally, then they'll go and connect to the nearest water source, which might not be the most healthiest source, the most convenient source. This is why we're finding people also living across like in dry riverbanks or close to bodies of water that get flooded occasionally. And every now and again, you have homes that are swept up because people do not have the historical knowledge that 5 years ago, this was some kind of a river or some kind of a dam that actually existed here. Next thing, they'll want electricity. This is where you start getting cable theft. This is where you get transformer theft. You know, so it becomes a spiraling effect. And you can imagine this happens each month with 30,000 new people coming. At the end of the year, you are sitting with 360,000 new people, government, local government, that did not prepare for any of these people. And therefore, this is why the tension, especially in townships, seems to permeate and become larger than life, ultimately.
Well, this is unscripted, and I would like to ask this question. I've always wanted to ask this question to people who understand energy, fossil fuels, and climate change, that why is there no urgency to move away from fossil fuel? Who is benefiting from us staying where we are when there are so much risk? You know what happened to Mozambique in terms of climate change, the phenomena that happened there, the flooding that continues to happen just in our backyard here in Johannesburg, and so forth. And the KZN floods in last year, April, that where many people died, and those were associated with climate change. So why isn't the urgency to move away from fossil fuel? And I suppose it takes us, maybe it could take us to the political will that we spoke about earlier. But I would like to hear your thoughts on this one.
So the big thing is that fossil fuels play a very important role in the energy mix, but more importantly, in grid stability. Now, what renewables do is that as awesome as they are and the benefit that they provide, but they're very limited in their use. You cannot have solar unless you have maybe clear blue skies, or even if you don't have clear blue skies, but your irradiation is certainly affected, which is what you require for your solar panels to actually function. Wind, if the wind is not blowing, you're not going to have it either. Now, what this means is that if you have a system like the Eskom system, you can only have renewables up to a certain point before you start compromising the grid itself and the ability to provide electricity. We'll look at a country like Germany. Germany for the last 10 years has been on a full-out war against fossil fuels, and they have switched off and some of their nuclear, some of their coal. And what we've seen, especially over the last year, is that even though they've got over a 200% reserve margin, this means in excess of what they need, they had to go back to coal, because the intermittency of renewables is so massive that on one day, everything could be on, and 2 hours later, there's no sun, there's no wind, everything is off. And you basically are back to your coal and your gas. So this is why there's a fine line of how you can introduce renewables into the system, but they can certainly not take over everything.
And do you, I'm just thinking hypothetically now, do you think we can get to a point where, because you know, in South Africa, we have these government subsidized homes where government says for every RDP house, that as we call them, I'll give you a solar panel, and they subsidize them. Do you think that's something that, or maybe an organization like Power for All can actually come and facilitate this on behalf of government?
You know, I've heard quite a few of these recommendations, and it will work. Technically speaking, it will work. It will certainly save Eskom that additional demand. Herein comes the problem, that you need a lot of battery for these people not to come back online. Otherwise, every evening at 6:30, these people will come back and they'll create a massive surge that the Eskom system operator will have to deal with, which is problematic in and of its own. So that's the first thing. Secondly, like all initiatives, it needs funding. So in 2008, if you recall, Eskom had a program where people went around to people's homes and they were exchanging light bulbs. There were solar water heaters, there were solar geysers, a number of various initiatives. But one thing people might not know is that it might have been a free issue to you, but it was actually put into your tariff. So your electricity tariff. So the question is now, if we're saying let's put solar PV on people's rooftops, you're really only talking about rich people, because they're the only ones that have roofs that are stable enough for that kind of, you know, structure for those panels, homes that are secure enough also, because you're certainly not going to put this system in an informal settlement. So now it means that somebody in Olifantshoek, in my instance, because I live in the city of Tshwane, someone in Olifantshoek, through their tariff, would need to subsidize me, who lives in a gated community, to have that PV system on my rooftop. This further exacerbates inequality in our country. If yes, government could out of some way find a billion, and that was non-reimbursable, and basically give these free issues or some kind of a tax break. But anything that involves the tariff involves the indigent, the poor, the middle class, and the rich, and that is inequality.
That sums it up nicely. Thank you so much for your insights, and I really appreciate your time with the Power for All podcast. And I hope we'll do some more, even if it means you putting us in your very busy schedule, because I know you're very busy. Thank you so much, Lungile.
Only a pleasure. Anytime.
Thank you for listening. This is a reminder that you can find a wealth of sector news, analysis, and data on our website, powerforall.org, and our platform for energy access knowledge. It's also known as PEAK. You can also sign up to receive our monthly newsletter. And if you'd like to support our work, you can make a donation via our homepage. Speak to you soon on the next episode of the Power for All podcast.